Hey, what's up, you guys? A couple days ago, I recorded a reflection going point by point through Harrison Bucker's speech to Benedictine College. And there's a lot of beautiful things he said and a lot of things that should be grappled with and responded to and corrected because they're teachings about the Catholic faith that are, frankly, off. Here's the thing, guys. I'm glad I had a couple days to reflect on this before releasing this video because as far as the overall impact and cultural implications of his talk, I got to say the good that he's trying to do, the point of the whole thing, the thing he's going for, is saying, you know what, let's stand our ground. We're allowed to say those things that society tells us are off the table. That's a kind of courage that we need to find again as a people of God. So with that context, that I am going to dig into some things that he says that are confusing or that need some clarification and correction from the Catholic point of view, from the overarching cultural point of view, I stand behind him. I stand behind his courage. And I think that's frankly the more important part and the point of the talk that's capturing a lot of hearts. And with that context, here's my commentary. Thanks for watching. A speech by Harrison Butker is blowing up the internet. This is probably the most famous Catholic graduation speech of my lifetime, certainly the most talked about. A lot of you have seen it, many of you have read it. Most Catholics in America have heard about it, and it has the entire country divided. On one side, you have Butker's jerseys selling out. On the other side, you have about 150,000 people so far and counting, signing a petition to get him kicked out of the NFL and to ruin his life and career. And in a world that gives us only two options, thumbs up or thumbs down, I'm gonna shock you right now. And the things that Butker gets right are so good, they're so dang good that they're worth actually talking about. And I don't usually talk about other people's talks during my show, but this is worth talking about. And here's the thing, the things that he gets wrong, they're also worth talking about. So let's rip into these things point, point, point right now. Before I do that, two clarifiers. Number one, I am not attacking this poor guy's character. All right, that's above my pay grade. One of my dear friends, Father Joe Krupp, by the way, I'm leading a pilgrimage to Greece following the footsteps of St. Paul with Father Krupp. There's only 15 cabins available on our pilgrimage. Plug, plug, go to the show notes. The link is there. But Father Joe Krupp, who's also going to do a show on this week, follow him. He's amazing. He said, you know, Chris, thank God there was no internet when I was 28. Because if there was, I would have been canceled a long time ago. And I agree with him. I have some compassion on Butker. But two, if you think I'm wrong, please don't cancel. Leave stuff in the show notes. Guys, you don't have to cancel people you disagree with. Let's fight. I'm up for that. I will read all your comments this time. I don't always. I promised you this time. Leave them and I'll jump in. So let's start with what I loved.
As members of the church founded by Jesus Christ, it is our duty and ultimately privilege to be authentically and unapologetically Catholic. Don't be mistaken. Even within the church, people in polite Catholic circles will try to persuade you to remain silent. There even was an award-winning film called Silence, made by a fellow Catholic, wherein one of the main characters, a Jesuit priest, abandoned the church and as an apostate, when he died is seen grasping a crucifix, quiet and unknown to anyone but God. As a friend of Benedictine College, His Excellency Bishop Robert Barron said in his review of the film, it was exactly what the cultural elite want to see in Christianity, private, hidden away, and harmless.
Guys, I love calling out the problem of silence. This is a problem unique in American culture and the cultural experience of Catholics in America that we have this impression that we should leave our faith in a closet. In fact, there's this thing called separation of church and state, right? So we're supposed to respect that and keep our faith out of the public square. Actually, it's not true at all. Separation of church and state was put in place by the First Amendment, not so that the church would stay out of the way of the state, but so that the state would stay out of the way of the church. You see that distinction? See, when you don't see that distinction, people start to relabel freedom of religion, freedom to worship. Actually, Obama was the first one to use this phrase, freedom to worship, and it's really dangerous because freedom of worship is a freedom to pray your faith. Freedom of religion is a freedom to live your faith. Not just pray your prayers, but live your prayers in every aspect of your life. And why should you have that right? Because every single person who lives in a free country should have the right to have their fundamental convictions and worldview shape everything they do. I love thinking about the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. Guys, he didn't march on the nation's capital as a secular humanist. He marched there as a reverend, formed by biblical principles and preaching them and demanding that the entire country live up to them. Now, that's not the same as being a theocrat. He wasn't demanding that everyone go to church on Sunday. But general common good principles, informed, infused by his faith, he was pushing without any apology. Guys, don't be silent. Stop apologizing. He goes on further to call out how the church tends to go along with this culture in America that bullies people into silence. Check this out.
These are the sorts of things we are told in polite society to not bring up. You know, the difficult and unpleasant things. But if we are going to be men and women for this time in history, we need to stop pretending that the Church of Nice is a winning proposition. We must always speak and act in charity, but never mistake charity for cowardice.
Ouch. Listen, people say, what would Jesus do? And they often presume, well, Jesus was nice. So if you're going to do what Jesus would do, you should be nice. Guys, I want to burst your bubble. Jesus was not nice. Jesus was love. And sometimes love is not nice. Sometimes love demands that we speak truths that people don't want to hear. In fact, sometimes those truths can upset people and make them uncomfortable and hurt their feelings so much that this happens to you. And he didn't mince words. He promised us that that would happen to us. He said, blessed are you when they persecute you and hate you and say all kinds of vile things about you because of me. But he also said this, woe to you if you're nice. Woe to you if you shape your words in a way that love isn't the priority. And what's good for the other, even if it hurts them, and even if they hate you for it, isn't the priority, but being liked is your priority. Woe to you when everyone likes you and speaks well of you, because if that's the case, you're not loving them enough. You're doing it wrong. And guys, I get it. It's hard. The cross is hard. Don't compromise on the truth. Don't compromise on love either. You see, when these things combine, uncompromising truth and undying love, which you find yourself in, is a very precarious and painful situation, which is where Jesus was on the cross. And that's how he's calling us to live. And where has our silence gotten us? Guys, I think we've gone so far in accommodating the world, so far in making sure that we don't send this message that we're not welcoming, so far that the world overnight has pivoted to this place where, man, the ideologies around gender and marriage, it'll give you a whiplash. I mean, people are acting and shocked if you don't agree with them on things that no one thought until 5 minutes ago. And every time someone is shocked and aghast that you don't agree with the gender ideology laid out, how is that possible? You realize you didn't think that 5 minutes ago, right? But this is where silence gets us. We think that by being silent, we're sending the message that we're welcoming and we're accommodating and we want you here. Guys, that's true. We are welcoming. We are accommodating. We do want everybody. But silence isn't how you convey that. And where's our silence gotten us? Man, Catherine of Siena said, we've had enough exhortations to be silent. Cry out with 1,000 tongues. I see the world is rotten because of silence. And guys, I'll tell you what, if this is getting internet support that's blowing up behind this speech, it's because it's so apologizing. He goes on further to call out how the church tends to go along with this culture in America that bullies people into silence. Check this out.
These are the sorts of things we are told in polite society to not bring up. You know, the difficult and unpleasant things. But if we are going to be men and women for this time in history, we need to stop pretending that the Church of Nice is a winning proposition. We must always speak and act in charity, but never mistake charity for cowardice.
Ouch. Listen, people say, what would Jesus do? And they often presume, well, Jesus was nice. So if you're gonna do what Jesus would do, you should be nice. Guys, I wanna burst your bubble. Jesus was not nice. Jesus was love. And sometimes love is not nice. Sometimes love demands that we speak truths that people don't want to hear. In fact, sometimes those truths can upset people and make them uncomfortable and hurt their feelings so much that this happens to you. And he didn't mince words. He promised us that that would happen to us. He said, blessed are you when they persecute you and hate you and say all kinds of vile things about you because of me. But he also said this, woe to you if you're nice. Woe to you if you shape your words in a way that love isn't the priority, And what's good for the other, even if it hurts them, and even if they hate you for it, isn't the priority, but being liked is your priority. Woe to you when everyone likes you and speaks well of you, because if that's the case, you're not loving them enough, you're doing it wrong. And guys, I get it, it's hard. The cross is hard. Don't compromise on the truth. Don't compromise on love either. You see, when these things combine, uncompromising truth and undying love, what you find yourself in is a very precarious and painful situation, which is where Jesus was on the cross. And that's how he's calling us to live. And where has our silence gotten us? Guys, I think we've gone so far in accommodating the world, so far in making sure that we don't send this message that we're not welcoming, so far that the world overnight has pivoted to this place where, man, the ideologies around gender and marriage, it'll give you a whiplash. I mean, people are acting and shocked if you don't agree with them on things that no one thought until 5 minutes ago. And every time someone is shocked and aghast that you don't agree with the gender ideology laid out, how is that possible? You realize you didn't think that 5 minutes ago, right? But this is where silence gets us. We think that by being silent, we're sending the message that we're welcoming and we're accommodating and we want you here. Guys, that's true. We are welcoming. We are accommodating. We do want everybody. But silence isn't how you convey that. And where's our silence gotten us? Man, Catherine of Siena said, we've had enough exhortations to be silent. Cry out with a thousand tongues. I see the world is rotten because of silence. And guys, I'll tell you what, if this is getting internet support that's blowing up behind this speech, it's because it's so refreshing to hear an unapologetic call to courage. It is. But here's where I think it goes wrong. Okay, courage is one of the four cardinal virtues. The cardinal virtues are prudence, justice, fortitude, courage, and temperance. And they're cardinal virtues because every other virtue hinges on and grows from them. But of these cardinal virtues, one of them is the hinge of them all, and it's prudence. Prudence is the hinge of all of them because any one of them, without being hinged in prudence, can metastasize and can end up killing you. It becomes bad, it can become poisonous. All right, think about the soldier who's so courageous that at the wrong time, he just is overcome by courage and runs out of the foxhole into no man's land, across enemy lines, and is shot instantly and gives up the position of his entire platoon. Butker, you're so courageous, man. I wish the prudence and wisdom in this speech matched your courage, because then I would say, with many other Catholic influencers, this is the best speech ever. But it's not. Okay, and here's where there's some unhinging of courage from prudence. And I don't mean psycho unhinging, I just mean unhinging in the moral sense.
We fear speaking truth because now, unfortunately, truth is in the minority. Congress just passed a bill where stating something as basic as the biblical teaching of who killed Jesus could land you in jail.
Okay. The problem with that statement is it's not true. Congress did not just pass a bill saying you can go to jail for saying that Jews killed Jesus. That didn't happen. There is a bill that targets federal funding of universities for doing things that are deemed anti-Semitic speech and for allowing anti-Semitic speech. But there's nothing in that bill that says that you should go to jail if you say that Jews killed Jesus. Well, who cares? He's on Team Jesus, so go team. Let's overlook that inflammatory inaccuracy and all that wrong information. No, how about we don't? You see, because here's the thing. When you're courageous without carefully conveying the truth, what you do with that lack of prudence, moderating the courage, is undermine our entire mission. That's what you do. That's what you're not taking seriously anymore. But I also want to pick at a lack of necessary nuance in this speech in this moment. He said, who killed Jesus? Now, the biblical teaching about who killed Jesus is actually not just the Jews, but historically it's the Jews and Romans together. And if there's anybody who actually drove the nail into his hands, it was the Romans. But even more specifically, who killed Jesus? The spiritual biblical teaching is very clear on this. It's you and it's me. There's a beautiful scene in The Passion of the Christ. Mel Gibson isn't in the movie except for one scene, and the only part of him that's in the movie is his hand. It's the moment where the nail is driven into Jesus' hand, and the hand holding the hammer is Mel's hand. How stunningly beautiful is that? Who killed Jesus? I did. Guys, that nuance isn't just to appease a woke crowd. That nuance is more spiritually accurate. I think sometimes nuance is pretty dang important. And now, to where it unhinges a little more, and instead of sounding like a grad speech, no offense, brother, this starts to sound like what some of my friends at the Pillar said feels like a, quote, Catholic Festivus. And if you pick up on that, high five.
Because sadly, many priests we are looking to for leadership are the same ones who prioritize their hobbies or even photos with their dogs and matching outfits for the parish directory.
Look, there's a tendency to say things that broadly condemn groups of people without specification and leave us with a church that's looking around and saying, is he talking about you? Is he talking about you? Far be it from me to call my Pope on something, but I don't think he's such the best example in this way. I've heard so many papal statements that kind of broadly condemn, you know, you American conservatives or you young priests who have this backwards mindset. And it's so unspecific that literally everyone's thinking, like, is he talking about me? He's talking about you? Guys, that's not the atmosphere of charity and love that Jesus wants us to have in the church. But it's not just the Pope, dude. I fall into this. We all tend to fall into this in a digital age where you can say something without thinking it through carefully. I know so many priests who have poured out their life for the church. I mean, really? These guys are doing more for Jesus and giving up more for Jesus than I will or that you will as a kicker who gets paid good money to give a talk. So they have some hobbies. So they like rock climbing or skiing or playing with their dog. Leave them alone. There's my shout out for my priest friends. Now, we're going to pivot back to his call to courage, which is phenomenal. It's worth diving into. Stay with me. And in a minute, we're going to get to the call to courage that has the country blowing up. All right, so check this one out.
As we saw during the pandemic, too many bishops were not leaders at all. They were motivated by fear of being sued, fear of being removed, fear of being disliked. They showed by their actions, intentional or unintentional, that the sacraments don't actually matter. Because of this, countless people died alone without access to the sacraments, and it's a tragedy we must never forget.
Guys, I'm so glad he said this. I'm so glad he went here, and here's why. There's a tragedy that so many people in church leadership were guilty of that we should never forget. And to just move on from it without calling it out and without repentance from the church isn't doing us any good. I actually know of one priest who stayed in his rectory. There was an accident outside. The cops came to the door and said, there's a guy dying. He wants last rites. The priest said, I'm not going outside. COVID. I'm not administering the sacraments right now. That's an extreme example of what happened when bishops and priests just went missing during the entire time. Now, I don't want to debate whether or not the doors should have been open the entire time or how quickly they should have opened. That's a whole other issue for a whole other show. But I know priests whose hearts were with their people the entire time. There's one parish in Celebration, Florida, where the priest literally took a picture of each parishioner, printed it out, and posted it to the pews so that his live stream masses, they could see their faces sitting where they usually sat. You better believe that church was full of parishioners the second the doors reopened. Because he loved them. He was present to them. He was calling them and saying, how you doing? Guys, we failed big time as a church. It shows in our numbers not coming back. And it wasn't just this message that sacraments aren't important. It was a message that you're not important to me. Lord, help us all to do better. All right, now, that was good. It was a call to courage, a call to repentance, frankly, and something we should never forget. But now back to these sweeping judgments.
When a bishop of a diocese or the bishop's conference as a whole puts out an important document on this matter or that, nobody even takes a moment to read it, let alone follow it. No. Today, our shepherds are far more concerned with keeping the doors open to the chancery than they are with saying the difficult stuff out loud. It seems that the only time you hear from your bishops is when it's time for the annual appeal. Whereas we need our bishops to be vocal about the teachings of the church, setting aside their own personal comfort and embracing their cross. Our bishops are not politicians, but shepherds. So instead of fitting in the world...
Okay, our bishops. I'd like to ask, which ones? All of them? Because here's the deal, man. I know so many bishops who work so hard to make a lot of statements about really important things, and people don't listen and people don't read them. Why? Is it the bishop's fault? No, it's because our world is so constantly distracted with shallow, passing news. That's partially why. Our bishop, Archbishop Aquila, releases beautiful statements all the time. Him and his staff struggle really hard to have people hear them, and he's bold and he's courageous. But many people only really see him when it's time for the annual appeal. That's true. Is that his fault? No, it's because people get bugged when you ask them for money. But you know, all they care about is keeping their chancery door open. I've worked for chanceries. I've worked with the people who are working in those chanceries. You know the kind of things they're doing is they, quote, keep their doors open? They're feeding the poor. They're housing people with no housing. They're running youth ministries in a world that's gone crazy to try to keep kids in their faith. That kind of sweeping condemnation that is empowering people to pass rash judgments on their bishop the next time they hear an annual appeal and to not support it and to write their bishop off is totally unjust. Sorry, I'm getting fired up. I'm getting fired up because I got personal friends who are bishops who work so stinking hard. I love you guys. They're not all perfect. Neither are you. All right, now we pivot back to great. And this is the clip. It's funny, I'm taking issue with all these other points that no one's talking about. This is the part that everyone's talking about, that the country's blowing up about, and you either love it or you hate it. I actually love it. All right, here it is.
I want to speak directly to you briefly because I think it is you, the women, who have had the most diabolical lies told to you. How many of you are sitting here now about to cross this stage and are thinking about all the promotions and titles you are going to get in your career? Some of you may go on to lead successful careers in the world, but I would venture to guess that the majority of you are most excited about your marriage and the children you will bring into this world. I can tell you that my beautiful wife, Isabel, would be the first to say that her life truly started when she began living her vocation as a wife and as a mother. I'm on this stage today and able to be the man I am because I have a wife who leans into her vocation. I'm beyond blessed with the many talents God has given me, but it cannot be overstated that all of my success is made possible because a girl I met in band class back in middle school would convert to the faith, become my wife, and embrace one of the most important titles of all, homemaker.
Hallelujah. I love seeing a man get choked up in gratitude for the beauty of his wife's vocation. And in gratitude that she's living it out in that specific way by saying, you know what, I'm going to push the career stuff aside and be a homemaker. How beautiful is that? Guys, there's a difference between your career and your vocation. Your career is the stuff that fills your resume. Your vocation is the stuff that fills your eulogy. I went to a dear friend's funeral the other day, and he had a great career. He was one of the top dentists in Denver. 5280 magazine rated him as the top dentist in Denver. I'm sure he was very wealthy and successful and had a great practice. Almost none of that was mentioned in the eulogy. The stuff that was mentioned had to do with how he was as a dad, how present he was to everybody, how much he loved Jesus and how much he served people. But we rush into life obsessed on careerism in a way that overlooks our vocations. And we have a world that devalues people living their vocation in the direct kind of way that his wife was blessed to be able to do that. Now listen, if I were him, don't get me wrong, I absolutely would have worded that differently, okay? I would have brought up my vocation as a father, that of all the honors I'll get in my career, the greatest honor bestowed on me is the title father and husband. This is not something specific to women. I would have made sure that I didn't say something like, her life began when, right? Because, I mean, obviously he meant that as a literary device, not literally. But, you know, there's a lot of women who are struggling with, like, I haven't met the guy yet. That doesn't mean your life hasn't begun yet. Your life begins when you live in Jesus Christ. And you just surrender to whatever he wants for your life, right? I would have encouraged women that, you know, for people who have to work, because not everybody marries someone who's making $5 million a year as a professional NFL player, or 2 million, or whatever million number it is. For people who have to work, that's totally fine. You gotta do what you gotta do, man. And you can still live out the beauty of motherhood and homemaker with that job. And you know what? There's even more courage and heroism in that for a lot of people. I would have clarified all those things. But guys, I would have worded it better is as far as I go in my critique of that. It really is. How far has the world gone? 150,000 signatures to have him banned from the NFL. The man might lose his career. He's being doxxed. People are releasing his address to the public so that people will go to his house and threaten him and his family. He's being labeled a misogynist. A misogynist. Isn't it funny how every rapper who talks about using women gets a free pass? But you talk about how beautiful it is that your wife is a homemaker and you're labeled a misogynist? People are saying, he's saying that women shouldn't work and that they should be home barefoot and pregnant, locked in their house and have to ask their husbands for permission to leave the house, right? That's how far people are going on their accusations about this guy. Okay, here's the deal. Here's my challenge to you. The first person that could show me the quote from his talk that says that women should not work, should not be allowed to have a job, I will literally send you $100. Go ahead, show me the quote. Show me where he says that, because it's not in there. He even talks about friends of his who have a career. He's implying that it's okay. This kind of stuff drives me nuts. But I'll tell you, I'd agree with what he kicked it off with. The world's response validates that this attack on these traditional roles of male and female and the beauty of family life at its core is actually a diabolical attack. So my advice to you, Butker, just let it fly. Sometimes the best way to counter someone in a debate is just to step back and let them take the floor and just watch. Let everyone watch. You just said this is a diabolic lie. The response of the world is, no, it's not. I'm going to cancel you and kill you and your family. I cede the rest of my debate time to my opponent in the interest of fairness. All right. Dude, just sit back and watch as your opponents spin their heads and let pea soup spew out all over the room and claim it's not a diabolic lie. And it gets even better.
To the gentleman here today, part of what plagues our society is this lie that has been told to you that men are not necessary in the home or in our communities. As men, we set the tone of the culture. And when that is absent, disorder, dysfunction, and chaos set in. This absence of men in the home is what plays a large role in the violence we see all around the nation. Other countries do not have nearly the same absentee father rates as we find here in the US, and a correlation could be made in their drastically lower violence rates as well. Be unapologetic in your masculinity, fighting against the cultural emasculation of men.
Brother, thank you for going here. Men, you are needed. You're needed. I mean, the only thing that guys hear today from society is we don't want you to be toxic. And when you ask, well, what should I be? Their answer is, I don't know, just don't be toxic. Toxic masculinity. I created this beautiful program for men called Rise. By the way, plug, plug, link in the show notes. We have a whole platform with our coaching courses, and Rise is one of them, and it's changed so many men's lives. It also helps support our work and keep it going. So there it is. But my friend who filmed it, he said he was sharing about it with a friend and how it's about finding masculinity, but in a good way. That he had to say, but in a good way. And why? Because as soon as someone hears the word masculinity, they automatically insert the word toxic in front of masculinity. Man, you just come in the way of people's fulfillment. You're just inherently toxic. And you can only be good for society if you learn to keep that toxicity, which is inherent in your being, in check. And guys are hearing the message and they're checking out. Less and less guys are getting married. More and more guys who get married are being unfaithful. Less dads are raising their kids. In America, 40% of homes are dadless. In some inner city communities, it's 70%. And what he said about how the absentee father rates correlate with violence, that's not misogynistic and it's not sexist. It's a fact. Check this out. These are real stats. Children without dads in their home have a 4 times greater likely risk of growing up in poverty, 7 times more likely to become pregnant outside of wedlock, which perpetuates that cycle. 85% of kids who struggle with behavioral disorders come from dadless homes. 70% of kids in drug rehab centers come from dadless homes. From the smaller percent comes the vast majority of these kids. Fatherless kids are infinitely more likely to end up in prison, become drug addicts, drop out of school. The list is endless. Men, the world needs you. I'm glad he said that. I'm glad he reminds you that. Now, if he had just stopped there, if he just stuck to the lane of courage, dude, he could have even correlated it with the fear of guys running at you to tackle you. Man, I want to write your next speech. If he'd stuck there, it would have been awesome. But he didn't. And here's where there's an unhinging again. And this one's actually really serious.
Heterodox ideas abound even within Catholic circles. For let's be honest, there is nothing good about playing God with having children, whether that be your ideal number or the perfect time to conceive. No matter how you spin it, there is nothing natural about Catholic birth control. It is only in the past few years that I have grown encouraged to speak more boldly and directly.
All right, here, guys, in not so veiled terms, he's condemning what's called natural family planning. Now, if you're not a Catholic insider, natural family planning is not the, quote, rhythm method. There's a name for people who do the rhythm method. It's called mom and dad. And that's a good thing, don't get me wrong. But natural family planning, no fun for Papa. Natural family planning is about reading how your body works in a more intimate kind of way to know when a woman is fertile, when she's not, and when you don't want to get pregnant, when it's not the right time, to use your natural body's powers and cycles to refrain from intercourse during those times so you don't take advantage of the gift of your fertility, instead of treating your fertility like it's a disease and treating it with pills. So it's healthier for the marriage, it's healthier for the woman's body. You're working with her body rather than against it. That's a beautiful thing. Now, here's the funny thing, guys, and here's where he goes totally wrong. He warns throughout the speech against heterodoxy. It's a word he uses a couple times. If we're using as the standard for orthodoxy the things that the church officially teaches from the magisterium, the Pope and the Bishops United, and teaches throughout history, this idea that you should throw caution to the wind and not use your reason and never practice natural family planning is totally heterodox. The church is completely clear on this, that husbands and wives don't just have the freedom, but a moral obligation to discern carefully when they should have children and when they shouldn't. And if there are grave reasons to postpone a pregnancy, you shouldn't just throw caution to the wind and say, God will not let us get pregnant. No. God is the primary cause. Secondary causes is a way he uses his powers to bless the world. And one of the great secondary causes that he shows his providence in your life is your reason. It's your ability to think and have a conversation with your spouse. And it's that thing called self-control. Guys, you know what one of the great tricks of the devil is? It's to take a command of God, a beautiful, reasonable, liberating command, and to expand it to something God didn't say. And as a guy who's an evangelist, who spends most of his life trying to get people to come into the Catholic faith, one of the big obstacles I face is people have these misperceptions about the church that it teaches so much more than it does and requires so much more than it does. And they're like, I can't do that. I don't want to do that. If that's what God requires, I'm out. Guys, he doesn't require that. He's given you reason. He expects you to use it. And he really loses me on this one. And I got to go here.
I do not attend the TLM because I think I am better than others or for the smells and bells or even for the love of Latin. I attend the TLM because I believe, just as the God of the Old Testament was pretty particular in how he wanted to be worshiped, the same holds true for us today. It is through the TLM that I encountered order and began to pursue it in my own life. Aside from the TLM itself, too many of our sacred traditions have been relegated to things of the past, when in my parish, things such as Ember Days, days when we fast and pray for vocations and for our priests, are still adhered to. The TLM is so essential that I would challenge each of you to pick a place to move where it is readily available. A lot of people have complaints about the parish or the community, but we should not sacrifice the Mass for community. I prioritize the TLM even if the parish isn't beautiful, the priest isn't great, or the community isn't amazing. I still go to the TLM because I believe the holy sacrifice of the Mass is more important than anything else.
I gotta be really clear, guys. I think the TLM is beautiful. I have dear friends who go to TLM, and I love that people are able to take advantage of it. But in brief, I want to go over a few reasons why what he's saying is wrong. Number one, it presumes that the Mass came straight from God as it was in 1962 Roman Missal and has never changed. And that's absolutely not true. The Mass has changed many times in 2,000 years. But two, and this is more important, here's the essentials. Here's the essence of Mass. 1 Corinthians 11. I received from the Lord what I passed on to you. The Lord Jesus, on the night before he was betrayed, took bread. And when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, "This is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me." That's the what of the Mass. The how of the Mass. That's not the same as the what of the Mass. I'm not saying it's unimportant. It's actually very important because the what is so important. But as far as the how this mystery is delivered to each culture and each generation, there are 33 liturgical rites. All of them look different. And there have been, throughout history, additions and subtractions to all of them. And guess which Mass is valid? And guess which Mass will be received by your Heavenly Father as worship? Every single approved Mass from the Church. The Church, which has authority to say which Mass is approved and which isn't. You want to talk about staying in your lanes? Butker, this is not your lane, dude. You don't get to say which Mass is approved by God and which isn't. That's the Church's job. And if the Church is doing something wrong on those lines, then the leadership in the Church can stand in judgment before God. Again, not all my friends who go to TLM think this way. Most of them don't. But I'm responsible for the spirit that I bring into the Mass. Now, to be fair, it's okay to debate what changes happened in Vatican II. Which parts of the how maybe could change again, because they absolutely can. But that doesn't invalidate a Mass. Because I agree on this point. God is, quote, pretty particular about how he wants to be worshipped. Here's how he wants to be worshipped. He wants you to remember that every single Mass, in the words of Archbishop of Fulton Sheen, the curtain of time is torn in two. At every Mass, you and me are there at Calvary. We are there at the empty tomb. We're there. He's not sacrificed again and again. We're brought into direct contact to what he did for us. And why? Because it didn't satisfy his love for you that you and me would hear about him from a guy on a podcast. The only thing that satisfied his love is that everybody who would follow him throughout history would have a chance to be there directly and to hear body of Christ, not for the whole world, but for you, for you, for you, and for you. And as we receive his life, we commit to bringing that divine life to the world through our words, through our worship, through our service. God is particular about that. That's how he wants to be worshiped. Guys, you miss the point of that, you just miss the whole point of what Mass is about. So, in summary, and if you disagree with half of what I said, enter stuff in the show notes. I will jump right in. Let's have at it. We'll see you next time.